From Relay FM, this is Downstream, a podcast about the present and future of streaming media. This is episode 69. Nice. Recorded May the 17th, 2023. I am your master of ceremonies, Jason Snell. And with me, as always, Julia Alexander, director of strategy at Parrot Analytics, and of course, director of strategy of this podcast. Hi, Julia. How are you?
Hi, good. How are you?
I'm doing great. Did a lot of travel the last couple of weeks. Was near you because I was in Lower Manhattan, but I was there for like a day as an Apple event, and then I was gone again. So I did think about, I heard the traffic noises outside and I thought of you.
Well, Jason, can you, I think embargo on the iPad's up, right? Is it, can you
I wrote about it this week. Beautiful screen, OLED screen. Like it is the best, if money is no object, it is the best portable video watching device you will find because of that OLED screen. So. Yeah.
Do you think the this is not a, a downstream necessarily question, but I do think our audience would be interested in it. Do you think the goal of Apple is to eventually, and I mean eventually like 30 years from now, not like 4 months from now, is to have the iPad specifically replaced by the Vision Pro? Because not the iPhone, but the iPad, which is very like reading and video and...
I think the
productivity.
I think the Vision Pro's long. I think the Vision Pro exists because Apple is concerned that in the long run, some glasses you wear will replace the smartphone and the tablet and all those things. Because once it's in your field of vision, everything you know, you could put all kinds of computing on there. But that is, yeah, that's probably 10, 15, 20 years off. But I think that it's a hedge against those things falling apart. But I'm sure they're experimenting with iPhones that can fold to become iPads and iPads that can fold to become iPhones and all sorts of things like that too. And they're just, they don't feel that that technology is there yet. But I think it is interesting to realize that these devices that we think of as computers really are, one of their key things now is being a media player. Like that is,
that's as the bad commercial suggested.
Yeah. Well, among the
that
many
Apple
things.
Then apologize.
Many, many things that are smashed by a hydraulic press into that iPad. That's how they make them. They don't like to talk about it, but that's how they make them in the factory in China, is they load them full of creative things and then they crush them until there's an iPad.
The secret's out.
It's a true story. It's not true. Not actually true. Hey, Julia, we should talk about the great rebundling because the number one topic, I think, in the last 2 weeks has been bundle stories, Disney, Hulu, and Max. So a Disney WBD announcement that they are going to bundle together. And I guess Disney is going to sell it, but like it's a way to get a little bit more money for all of them and to simplify the strategy. And there's some other reasons to do it. But the other bundle news, which I think was misread by people, is the Peacock Netflix Apple TV Plus bundle, which is a wild, when you on its face, it's like, what? What? But it's for Comcast customers. Mm-hmm. It is more like Charter giving you Disney Plus, because what they're basically saying is if you're a Comcast internet or TV customer, they will give you a single price for Peacock, Netflix, and Apple TV Plus. It is a bundle, but it's a bundle with a huge asterisk, which is it is for people who have Comcast equipment in their houses, basically. So not quite the same, but still bundles. We're headed for more bundles in the game. And there are a lot of people out there who are doing that kind of reductive thing of like, oh, you've reinvented cable. But that's, you wrote a piece at Puck about this. That's not what's going on. And I thought your piece was really great in saying that this is pay TV bundling in the old days was leverage. You would, you know, hold your valuable channels hostage and force them to pay for a bunch of weaker channels. And today, the lines, as you said, the lines between the distributors and the suppliers have evaporated. The relationship with the customer, the DTC, direct to consumer, is the key to this. And I thought you had a really great point, which is, why do you bundle? Bundles don't churn as much, and churn is the enemy. Bundles don't churn as much. So what do you think about the everything? Who was it who said, I forget it now, it was Barksdale back in the day.
Jim Barksdale.
Who said, the only way you make money, the only two ways to make money are debundling and rebundling.
Yeah. Which is a great quote that the Harvard Business Review brings up every year. And it's so funny.
Yep.
It's such a good quote. It's so funny. So something I like to tell our listeners about, because I feel like it's a fun peek behind the curtain, is Jason is not only our master of ceremonies, he is our master of outlining episodes. Mm-hmm. Like he does 100% of the work.
Part of the job of master of ceremonies is making the outline.
He does the outline, and he's got two of my favorite topics. And so we're starting with the great rebundling, and then we're going, and this is related to the great rebundling, but we're going to go into then Apple, Netflix, and Disney wanting to change the way people pay for their services.
Yeah.
Now, why are those two important? So this Puck piece came about because I was ranting, which I do often to my poor editors. And I was like, people keep calling it the new cable. First of all, everyone says that in a way of like, isn't this a great thing to go back to, as if we didn't hate cable, right? Like everyone hated cable. That was the joke. The running joke was no one had any love for their cable companies because they felt like it was a terrible product for consumers. But where cable had the biggest advantage was that you had a limited number of distributors with exclusive access to high premium or in-demand scripted and unscripted content that you had to go through the cable providers to gain access to. Mm-hmm. So if you think about it as just an average consumer journey, right? You go up to a door, you knock on the door. Hey, there are some people inside here. There's young Sheldon. He's a bad example. He's on CBS. But there is Dexter Morgan, and there is the Tony Soprano, and there's a bunch of people that I really want to hang out with. Those are maybe two people I wouldn't want to hang out with, but they came to mind. And I really want to go hang out with them. And this person who opens the door says, great, you can come in and hang out with them. It's going to cost you $200. And you say, man, I don't want to pay $200. But the guy at the door says, unless you want to hang out with them, you got to go through me. And so what a lot of people who were friends with these Dexter Morgan, Tony Sopranos, they said, cool, you guys are going to go hang out in this house and we're going to bring in 10 more of your other friends who people don't really want to hang out with. But because they want to get to you, they're willing to pay this gatekeeper $200 a month. And so we're actually going to get the gatekeeper to then pay us even more money because that gatekeeper wants these people in the house. So that way, when you, the consumer, want to go hang out with them, you have to pay this one specific person. So there's a limited pathway to go and get that content. And because there's a limited pathway, there's an incentivization on the supplier front. So that's your Disney's, your Paramount's, your NBC Unis. There is an incentivization to do two really interesting things. One is sell as many packaged networks as you can. The more networks you have, the more advertising revenue you can bring in, the more affiliate revenue you can bring in, and the more that you can trade on the package versus the network. So the example I like to use a lot is if you wanted ESPN, most households did. It was basically what kept the cable system thriving. It is still the leading cable channel today, even as cable declines. If you wanted ESPN, Disney would go, cool, here's ESPN 2 through 5, here's Freeform, here's Disney Channel. You got to buy all this to Comcast. You got to buy all this to Charter. And then even if the customers don't necessarily want it, they will buy this package because they want access to ESPN. So this is kind of how it worked. That also meant that it was in your favor, if you were a supplier, to spread out if you had hit shows, not amongst a network, but amongst networks. So you would take a certain rights for a game, you'd put on this network, or you might take a certain show and say, this could work on Freeform, but actually we're going to put it on Disney Channel because we want to then spread out the show and make these packages more alluring to the cable guys. That does not exist in streaming. And so I think this is where I really get frustrated when people are like, it's just cable redo, which is what one TV executive said to me. It's not cable redo because the number of distribution pathways has increased enormously. Okay, you can go and get your shows via Apple, Amazon, Roku, Google. You can go into your web browser and go that way. You can get it through your connected TVs. You can get it through your PlayStation. The ways to access that content have increased. Furthermore, in order to get access to these shows, Mandalorian, Bridgerton, whatever it might be, you can just go directly to that source.
Yeah.
You don't necessarily need to have Hulu if you don't want Hulu, right? And so this is the big thing. And then the last point to what Jason was saying about churn, I can also cancel these after 30 days. It was really complicated in cable. It was dang near impossible.
And no alternative in most cases, right?
And like, there was no alternative. That was the other thing. Like you couldn't be like, oh, I only want this one now and it's fine for the month and I want this one. And so if you take away all of that guaranteed safety that comes within that infrastructure of cable, what you are left with is a bunch of bundles, but those bundles, you can still access that content a la carte, right? So yeah. this is the last point. This is the biggest point. It's not like Disney is saying, in order to get Max, Disney Plus, and Hulu, the only way to do it is via us, and you're going to pay us whatever. They haven't announced the price. Let's say $25. You're going to pay us $25, and you're going to be able to have access, and this is the only way to do it. You can still say, I really only want Disney Plus. I really only want Max. I really only want Max and Hulu. And you can create your own. And until that changes, the infrastructure of cable is never replicated, which hurts the distributors and it hurts the suppliers. And the last thing I'll say on this, and then Jason, I'll get your points on this too. The clear winner in this conversation is not necessarily the Netflixes and Disneys, although they are strong SVODs. It's not necessarily the Charter and Comcast who are trying to figure out, well, how can they bundle these things? To Jason's point, you've got Comcast bundling some of these streaming services for their broadband and wireless customers mm-hmm. to really increase usage on that route. The real winners are the Apples and Amazons and Rokus and Googles, because they get to take 15 to 30% of all signups. They also get to take, for some of these companies, a portion of advertising, like the percentage of the advertising inventory, which if you're Amazon or Roku, less so Apple right now, but that could change. Really important. And fundamentally, the reason why it's advantageous to these guys, the cable distributors needed content. That's what they were selling. It was access to content. Apple and Google and Amazon, these streaming services are just additional things to do in a sea of millions of things to do. So it is an app, and they like the app because people do come in and they spend time and they pay and they subscribe to it. And so Apple, of course, wants to take some portion of that feed. Like, no one's playing that down, but it is a thing to do amongst a sea of things to do. And so that power dynamic where Apple says you need to be distributed via us because it's what, Jason, like 45-50% market share of iOS in the US, like in order to kind of reach some of that younger audience. They're coming in through us. They want to use Apple Pay to sign up. They want a frictionless sign up window or a way to do this. And in order for you to kind of have that reach, you're going to work within our limitations. And I think that is fundamentally the biggest shift with cable. Cable, by the end of the day, really empowered the suppliers. The suppliers were able to say that the distributors were only going to make money if they had the content that people wanted. And so they increased the level of content to increase their overall revenue and take advantages of the distributors. In 2024, the suppliers no longer have the same advantage. They no longer have the same guarantee. And the new distributors, which are Apple, Amazon, Google, Roku, don't necessarily have to say, okay, well, we want you and we need for this to happen, because there's other apps, there's other entertainment sources, there's other activities for them to kind of say, well, we have this going on, so it's fine. So I think that's what really drives me insane.
Yeah. It's not, I mean, yeah, for people who don't remember, like, cable, there's no choice. You have one cable company in most cases. Then later they came with DirecTV or Dish. And so you get two or three choices. Yes. The churn was brutal because first off, they would put you under contract, or with a satellite, they're putting a satellite dish on your roof or whatever. There's investment. It's hard to leave. They're just to rewire your house. All of those things make it hard. So there's kind of no churn and there's kind of no competition. It's very, very limited. And then there's no a la carte offer whatsoever. So if you only want Disney Plus, you can just pay for Disney Plus and get it. These bundles are ways to make you save a little money in order to get three services together. Like, I don't use ESPN Plus very much, but I'm paying for the trio or whatever they call it, the triple play at Disney and I basically they throw that in. And Apple does the same with their Apple One bundle, where they've got a bunch of different services that they, like, I'm not paying for Apple News really, but I get it because it's part of the bundle. But the fact is, you could buy those things separately if you wanted to. And that makes the consumer, I think, actually has way more choice. I see the complaint only from the perspective that if you want everything, you know, that you have to pay for everything. But the fact is, you don't have to pay for everything. You can want everything, but you don't have to pay for everything. And it used to, even then, used to be that you didn't have to pay for HBO or Showtime. They were add-ons. But everything else, ESPN, all the networks, all the other shows, you know, you basically took it or leave it. or took it or left it. And they would have like a cheap tier, but the cheap tier had almost nothing in it. And then the next tier up had everything in it. And that was just how you had no power. So it's not the same. It's similar, right? Bundling is reminiscent, but it's not the same. And actually, I think it's interesting because it's they are willing to trade. This is why I was surprised that there aren't more annuals. And we had a letter about this a while ago. More annual plan where you save a little bit of money, because the trade here is they get a little less churn for a little less revenue. And if you want to be committed to these services, that's a pretty good deal, right? You don't have to pay them as much. But you're going to stay with them for the whole year and you're not going to be able to churn. It's a little like those old 2 year long cable contracts or cell phone contracts. Yeah.
I suspect the annual will come back in some capacity as in an annual only option. I think for a lot of these companies, they're still having struggles onboarding customers. And so the annual comes at a steeper price. Like literally, but also if you are someone who is going to sign up for Netflix and it's $15.49 or $15.99 for the standard price, and then you're looking at Disney Plus, and Disney Plus is, let's say, $80 annually. I can't remember what it is, which is not, you know, it's not that much more if you then did the conversion of Netflix monthly to annual. But if you're like, oh, I'd rather spend $15 right now and then cancel versus $80 and I don't know if I'm going to use it. There's still that psychology that I think a lot of these companies don't necessarily have the scale and the relatively low churn rate right now to do annual only. Ironically, Netflix does. But I think they know that, and I think they are aware that they have low churn, and so they can just kind of keep the monthly packet or the monthly option as a way to ensure that their customers feel like they still have freedom of choice. But what I will say, which I think is something you got to the heart too of Jason, it's really important. When we look at the triple play, as you call it, which I think is what made me think of this, part of the advantage that the old school distributors had was that they had a triple play feature in the way they would approach customers. So it was this has changed, but as it stands right now, it's been cable, which is video. If you look at an earnings report, it's video, broadband, which is your internet connection, and wireless, which is your phone. And so a company like Comcast will have these three things. And broadband, when cable started to decline and video started to decline, broadband and wireless started to see increases. And so companies like Comcast said, okay, and Charter said, we're going to spend more time trying to get additional customers on broadband, even though that also comes with critical mass, because eventually most households will have this. You know, there's still some rural areas where that's complicated and the infrastructure is not there quite yet. But you look at broadband and wireless, you say, well, okay, well, how do we ensure that we are generating profit on these customers? Remember, these are companies. That's what they're thinking about. How do we increase profit every quarter? And one way to do that is by incentivizing people to use their connection more to watch things or to consume things or to play things. And so when you have something like Comcast saying for our broadband and wireless customers, as well as cable, but really they're focusing on broadband and wireless, we're going to give you this really, really heavily discounted, probably operating at a loss bundle between Peacock, which we own, Apple TV Plus, which just needs more customers, and Netflix, which would like more people on its ad supported tier. So it's kind of the perfect bundle for all three of those companies. We're going to give this to you, and we're hoping that you're just going to continuously stream your broadband, like your monthly bill, right? Like your monthly bill across wireless and internet goes up. And so that's how they kind of make a little bit more money. And the reality is, oh, you might have done this anyways, and we're just bundling for you, so you're actually going to save money on this front. So it's all customer psychology, right? It's why companies hire PhDs in this, because it's really figuring out how to do it. The thing is, the suppliers don't have that. When we look at how they are creating bundles, and this is where I have some concern. On the one hand, yeah, a lot of people, let's say hypothetically it's $25 to $30, $25 to like $29.99. A lot of people are going to say, okay, well, I like Hulu, I like Max, even though they're very complimentary. I like Disney Plus, and you know, I want the HBO side, so I'm going to get the bundle. This will reduce churn, but in the long term, it doesn't really do much to advance your business. It kind of creates this short-term pain relief. If we look at what the distributors did, they basically went across when they were creating triple plays and said, what do people do with their spare time? How do they access what they do with their leisure time? And then how do they communicate? Right? So it was, let us create verticals that are complementary to one another based on different activities and different needs that someone encounters throughout the day. That is a really smart way of building a flywheel business. What we're seeing happen here is not a flywheel business on the supplier side. What we're seeing is them saying we need to heavily reduce our churn so that we can create a consistent enough level of revenue to actually see where we should be investing in our in different areas. And my concern is that the lesson people will take away from this is that increasing supply is like one way to look at M&A. It is one way to look at partnerships. It is one way to look at what this industry needs and what streaming needs. When in fact, the lesson is that by creating these different bundles, what you're effectively doing is trying and saying like, okay, well, how can we just ensure that we're getting the most eyeballs locked in for the most amount of time? But even then, you look at the different structures in place. So the way that this is working with Disney, from what I understand in reading, I believe it was CNBC, who Alex Sherman had a great report on this, like HBO is going to be, like Max is going to be distributed via Disney. So like it will be a part of the Disney Plus bundle with Hulu. That means Disney collects all of the customer information. Yep. That means Disney gets to kind of control how people get to that, which is what I've been saying for a while with ESPN and what they were going to be doing there with the with local games and pushing people to where games are. It's like they're trying to command the front door of people's time on the internet. Oh, sorry, watching things on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Does that put Disney in the lead? It certainly gives them an advantage over Max. But still, who is Disney sold through, right? That's when it comes back to the Amazons and the Googles and the Apples. Mm-hmm. And so I think this is the inherent problem that still faces a lot of these companies. It's why you have a CEO like Bob Iger talking about Apple at a very public conference. It's this idea of we understand that our content is valuable and that if we combine it with other valuable content, we're much more valuable in the eyes of consumers. But we are still at the whim of the larger distributor, which in this case is big tech. And we are still paying a premium in many ways in order for our content to be surfaced and our content to be accessed. And that is going to make it really difficult to generate strong enough revenues and profits to ensure that as the cable business declines, we are finding some form of trade-off in the streaming space. And until that is figured out, on top of what are some additional necessity plays that they can expand into. So when people are not watching content, what else are they doing? Right? Gaming's the easy one that always people point out. Podcasting was an idea for a long time. Events were an idea for a while. You know, news was the idea for a while. So you can kind of look at the Apple bundle and get an idea. So if they're not doing this, where else can they be that I can then invest my resources into to ensure that we're capturing a wider breadth of people's interests and time on spent on the internet? That's where you get closer to like creating a world in which you own the supply and distribution of what you're trying to do and own that customer relationship. And until we reach that point, saying anything is close to cable just totally ignores the way that cable was set up and what made it arguably the greatest invention in like modern capitalism history.
Right. All right. Now shifting gears slightly to talk about another financial relationship, but it's how content creators are paid for the content that is being licensed by streamers. Now, you and I have talked about this a lot. I over the years, we've had some really good conversations about the lack of data, which is getting better, and how agents couldn't talk up their clients because there were no statistics about the shows being successful on Netflix because nobody had any numbers. And there are some stats now, but this all started with Netflix saying, look, we know you're not going to get any ratings or statistics, so we're just going to write you a check. And this is all you're ever going to get, basically, unless it leaves Netflix at some point. But basically, as long as that it's licensed to us and we have it, we're not paying you again. But we're going to pay you, I think the way it was described to me is paid as a moderate hit. So basically, we're just going to pay everybody what they probably would have made if it was a moderate hit. So if it was a flop, you're getting more. And if it was a huge hit, you're getting less. So you're taking a risk, but it's guaranteed money, which sounds great. I think if you're talent, although there were frustrations that you would have a huge hit like Stranger Things and it'd be like, wait a second. And then you'd renegotiate for more seasons and things like that. But that first little hit was, or Ted Lasso is a good example. It's like, wait a second. But we were a huge hit. you should pay us for that. And they're like, yeah, but we paid full price for this thing that was a flop too. Like, that's how it works. But if you're Jason Sudeikis, you don't want to hear that. So Lucas Shaw had a good piece in Bloomberg about this. Puck had a good piece about this too. And it's about reconsidering how, now that we've got a little more data, how the creative side gets paid and how the content gets paid out. So Apple wants to pay based on how a show or a movie performs when it's on the streamer, rather than paying a single fee up front. And the argument is, when you get $10 million, whether your show is good or bad, this is a quote in Lucas Shaw's story, you have less incentive to do it well. Now, I'm somebody who in my old job got a bonus that was tied to our company's profit, which was based on essentially ad sales. There was literally nothing I could do to affect my bonus number. It was structured in a way, bonuses are thought of as being like, well, you're giving an incentive to people to work harder and then they'll benefit from it. But I can tell you, as somebody in a creative pursuit, that sometimes it just doesn't work like that. And so when I read this, I like the idea in general that, like, if you have a hit, you should get compensated for it. And if it was kind of a flop, you should get a little less money. I don't have a problem with that. But the challenge is, and it's something that you have said from the beginning of this podcast, which is what a creative person would define as a success is not necessarily what a streamer would define as a success. And the thing that keeps coming up is, if Apple's goal or Netflix's goal, and the thing they shoot for in terms of how do we define success in that streamer, is bringing in new signups or reducing churn as opposed to maintaining, well, that's their business model talking. And I get it. But if I'm a creative person, if I'm an actor or a writer or a producer on a show, and I say, well, wait a second, I made a good show that everybody watched. That's all I can do. It's your job to figure out how that handles churn or signups. And the idea that as a writer or an actor, I would get paid more if there were more signups that quarter, but not based on the viewership. Like, I get why, but it strikes me that the two judgments are kind of orthogonal. So this sounds good. And by the way, Dan Lin at Netflix is planning on doing this with films, too. It's the same idea. But as the agents and talent say, we don't actually get a profit share. We don't actually get an ownership share. This is just a bonus that you're giving us. And do the bonus incentives match what they're capable of? Is it really the job of a producer to reduce churn? And how would you even design a TV show to reduce churn? It seems like it's out of their bailiwick to a certain extent. So I'm curious what you think about this. I don't think it's unfair to return some motivation and a reward for success and some punishment essentially for failure to the equation. But I do wonder if what a streamer calls a winner is just so far afield from what can be controlled by the people making the shows.
Yeah, it's also... So the funny thing about this conversation is that TV has always been a hits business. So is film, right? Like, if you go back the 1960s and 70s studio structure, a studio would release 10 films a year, hoping that at least one would be a hit, kind of right off the other nine.
It's betting, right? You pay for 10 shows, to simplify it. You pay for 10 shows or 10 movies, knowing that, what, five of them will lose money? Three of them will break even, and two of them will be huge hits that will pay the nut for the rest of it. And that's just how it is. So you're placing your bets and you want to be lucky, but you got to spread it out because not everything is going to be a hit. It is a gamble.
That's exactly right. It's why investors famously do not love investing in Hollywood.
No.
Right? Like there's many famous stories about this for this exact reason.
If you could wire it so that every time you won, everybody would do that, but it's just not possible with TV and movies.
One of the many jokes that has emerged out of a Warren Buffett, you know, taking the huge write down or not write down, excuse me, the huge loss on the Paramount investment that his company Berkshire Hathaway did, was this joke that, like, oh, like, someone should have told Warren you don't invest in Hollywood, right? Like that. There's been huge jokes about this. What I will say, though, is that because that has been known to be true for a while, so has the talent comp structure, right? So if you look at traditional film contracts, for example, typically, it is, Here's the upfront salary. It might be a little bit lower than it would be, you know, in another industry, but you're also going to make, like, let's say 3% on the back end, right? So the idea was that you were incentivized to create as strong a hit as possible. Not that you as an actor or you as a director could control that, but that if it was a great hit, you were going to continue making this money in the long run. The TV side had this same kind of structure. It was once you kind of got to that fifth season, then you could start syndicating that content on the back end because you owned part of it. You're going to be making much more money on it. What changed fundamentally with Netflix, right? I've been making this joke a lot to people, and I don't know if it works, but I'm going to test it here as well, which is that Netflix is very much the British Empire. You can point to it at almost any point in modern history and say, that's where trouble starts. And so when you look at Netflix, I think there is this component of they needed to find a way to incentivize talent to work with Netflix at a time when no one knew what it was. So they said, we're going to pay huge upfront. You're not going to have to worry about the gamble on the back end. You're going to get all this money up front. If it takes off, awesome. And if it doesn't, it doesn't. And with Netflix, the idea was that if it took off, then Netflix was going to maintain large forms of revenue, like on profit. That was great for them. And if it didn't, it didn't really matter anyways because the upfront fee was there.
Yeah.
So then this led, if you remember, Jason, in Netflix to a bunch of very strong overall deals. We're talking like anywhere between 8 to 9 figure overall deals with talent. Shonda Rhimes was one of them. Ryan Murphy was one of them. Varying levels of success. I think most people would point to Ryan Murphy and say hit rate was relatively lower than they would have wanted at Netflix compared to his hit rate at Disney with FX, where it's been a little bit higher. But then you look at Shonda Rhimes and Bridgerton alone. Right, is like this huge thing. And so they're going, okay, well, is that worth what we're doing on it? It was never, ever going to last. Like, you cannot continuously give people a ton of money up front and say that, okay, well, if these projects fail on average, which most of them are going to underperform on average, if you look at the number of titles being ordered, especially in the last 6-7 years, like, we've only just started slowing down, but each year, right, like John Landgraf, who's the head of FX, would get up at the Television Critics Association and do his State of the Union every year. And every year he would say, the number of series that we are pushing out is increasing at untenable levels. Like, we cannot maintain this.
Yeah, people miss that he would, the mayor of TV would declare peak TV and everybody like, peak TV. But he was sounding a warning when he did
exactly.
that.
Exactly. And something that he said was, you could give me 20 more people and to increase my number of shows by like 40%. And I still wouldn't have enough time to give the attention to each one to ensure the quality remains, right? Spoken like someone who comes, by the way, who heads up FX. You can imagine someone like Casey Bloys, who heads up HBO, saying the same thing. And so what happens is, so you've got all these series being produced at a higher rate. You've got more films coming out because people are going to theater. They still are maintaining the same level of theatrical load as they were in years past, even though there's a declining in attendance at the theaters. Not to be confused with revenue, because people say, well, the revenue is higher. It's because certain films are making $1 billion that they weren't. You can go and look at many charts on this if you're very interested. But more films are coming to streaming. So there's this huge investment in content happening, and there's this weird pay structure where now all these other companies have to match it, or else they're losing a lot of stuff to Netflix. So they go, okay, we'll do the similar things on our streaming services. And then what happened? One, there was the Netflix crash, right, which they rebounded from, but Wall Street pulled back, and Wall Street said, where's the profit on this? We're losing billions of dollars on this that you guys are doing, as well as you're seeing a decline in your theatrical, you're seeing a decline in linear. And so where's the profit at streaming? Well, now you can't just say, well, we're going to do this huge money up front and say, like, well, this is fine if it doesn't work out because we got to work with this talent. No, you're going to go back to, there is an incentivization for you to have a successful project, a hit, because we want hits and we want to be able to pay out based on hit. The one thing I will say, because you brought it up and it's really important, the other factor in this is that producers and talent never had to think, well, I shouldn't say never, but rarely had to think about the terms like acquisition and retention, right? If we look at where that really would have been an effective thing, there might be, and I'm not sure, actually, it's a really great question for Bellany, I can ask him, or Lucas, who might know. There might have been some of that contract language at like HBO and Showtime,
right,
because
you could literally say David Chase gets more money if The Sopranos comes on and there's a huge boost in HBO subs, because it was an option to turn it on and you really were trying to the most analogous to what we have with streaming services now, which was there was churn and you really wanted to get people on that plan to get HBO or Showtime. And so
exactly
maybe there. I don't know if that was the case, if David Chase got a little more money. If
I assume it was right. Like I assume there was an incentivization factor on like if it did this, you got this. But within that, you know, my favorite term of 2024, and I know one of my favorite and one of Jason's favorite newsletter authors, Ben Thompson, one of his favorite words, like there was a scarcity component of that, though. There were not that many showrunners and writers with shows on HBO. Like HBO was doing a limited amount. Showtime was doing a limited amount. Sure. By nature. They were doing a limited amount and they had the pay one and pay two films coming in. And so you only had a small pocket of an industry now saying, okay, well, we have this weird clause that's included in our contract that says there's this incentivization. When everything shifted to that model in the D2C transition, the direct consumer, now all of a sudden you had all of this different type of talent having to say, well, my show was responsible for this level, this percentage of sub acquisition or this percentage of retention. First of all, they don't have those numbers. I promise you they don't have those numbers. The talent is not given that those numbers. Two, because imagine if those were to leak. Like, not two, when you have more shows and films hitting a service at any given time than in history, the percentage of subscribers you are going to bring in or retain is going to be dramatically reduced. Because now you're operating on a much, much higher benchmark. That the average just kind of drops. And so that form of incentivization is actually not as powerful as incentivizing the hit. We might think it is, but if you're not getting those details and you're competing with 10 other shows in a similar genre, in a similar category, in the same country for, you know, 1% of subscriber acquisition, which would be relatively huge for a company like Apple, for example, that's a really tough metric to chase. And so I think when it gets back to what effectively Hollywood always was, which was this conversation of if you create a hit, you're going to be paid exponentially better than if you were to take a chance and you get paid, but you're not going to receive this kind of additional incentivization. That just gets back to the way Hollywood is always run. And I think a theme in these conversations that we are having, whether it is me ranting about cable, whether it is Jason really beautifully laying out the way that these metrics work for payment, it's this idea that there were elements of the old industry that worked, right? Like elements that I think a lot of these companies and these executives want to go back to. But once the genie is out of the bottle, it's really hard to get that genie back in. And so you can't go back to cable. Like, you already destroyed it. You took off all of your best non-sports programming, and now you're taking sports programming and you're moving it away. So you're disincentivizing customers to go down that route, even though it was generating billions of dollars. You're also saying, okay, well, we were giving all these creatives money up front, which, by the way, great for creatives. Like, it was a prosperous era for creatives. We're going to give all this money up front. We're going to increase writing rooms. We're going to do this. And all of a sudden it didn't work. Shocker, right? Like, it just wasn't working on average. You're losing money. And so you have to say, like, and you're not Apple and Amazon for the most part, who can just say, okay, we'll sell a phone, we'll sell dog food, and it's fine. Now it's like, okay, well, we have to go back to creating a structure that ensures that we're going to get paid as a company, and we're going to generate revenue as a company, and we're going to be able to write off our losses a little bit faster. And so you look back at what worked in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, early 2000s, but it's tough to go back there, especially when you've got really strong guilds and SAG-AFTRA and the WGA rightfully ensuring that their people are protected within the setting. And so it's hard to go back and say, okay, we're going back to the structure of 15 years ago. And so I'm curious to see what happens. Like what will happen is if Netflix is also agreeing to it, there's no option, right? Like, you talent will do what they need to do in order to work and get paid. But I think it's going to be a much slower moving pendulum swing back to the way payment structures used to work.
Yeah, there may be room for experimentation too, right? Like, because I went off on my rant about misalignment, and I do think that there's some misalignment here, and that, you know, you paying me based on a thing that I perceive as being under your control, which is how you promote my thing and how it works as part of your business model, versus I am giving you entertainment, but I also want to participate in its success and its upside. And so you pay me less, but I participate in the upside. That's the deal. I think there's room for experimentation there, and maybe
yes,
some trial and error, and the errors will be tough where you're like, oh, your thing was really well viewed, but it didn't really help us with new acquisitions, so you're not getting a bonus. And there'll be a story in Variety or the Hollywood Reporter about it, and somebody will be grumpy, and then somebody else will tell their agent, don't agree to a deal like that. And it, but you know, I think the fact is, I think a lot of talent, not all of them, maybe, I mean, there's some people who are probably more negative, but I think a lot of talent, what they really want is to protect themselves and give themselves the opportunity to hit it big, right? Like, that's the American dream, right? You hit it big. And getting, I know it's a psychological experiment. It's a little like giving a toddler a marshmallow and saying, don't eat this and you'll get another marshmallow. But saying, we're going to pay you middle-class wages, but you'll never get a chance to hit it rich. Versus saying, we'll pay you working-class wages, but if the thing you do is successful, you'll hit it rich. Like, a lot of people, I think, would be willing to take that deal, especially since they don't like the idea of having their thing that defines their career, that is the most successful thing they'll ever do, and all it does is make profit for the giant corporation that's paying them. I think that as there's a tendency among creative people, especially, to feel like they need to be a participant in the success of the thing that they created, whether it was a work for hire under a contract or not. So I feel like there's a deal to be struck here, but you got the level of trust about what the statistics are is going to be, to me, is going to be the big thing, right? Because if you get paid based on a number that comes out of a black box that the person who is paying you is generating, there needs to be a level of trust there.
Absolutely. And I think trust between the studio system and talent is at a low,
yeah,
which is heartbreaking, but understand, you get it from where talent's coming from. But I agree with you. And I think, like, I mean, this is the, you know, Aaron Schwartz fan in me. But like, information should be free. And I know, I understand why it's not. Like, I understand at the end of the day how negotiations work and leverage. And I understand all this. And I also understand how leaks can impact a public company stock. I get it. I totally get it. But I think, you know, part of the reason at Parrot that I helped set up the producer tier was this idea that I think it's really difficult to negotiate with studios and streamers and networks now more than ever, because some of the data, a lot of the data is been locked away and it's closed gardens. And so it gets really complicated. But I'm hopeful that, and Netflix has done a great job with this, Disney's been pretty good about finding its own way out there as well. The more data that we have publicly, the more that we can create benchmarks, and the more that we understand what value looks like in a streaming age, the more informed I think both parties can be about what they're selling, what they're buying, and to whom, and to how to make sure that partnership is built on trust.
Absolutely. Next topic, it's a quick one, but just a little follow-up. I have a Paramount update, just to say, it's all still going on behind the scenes. There was a good Puck story about this from William Cohen about how lots of negotiations are going on behind the scenes now that the exclusive negotiation period is over. It seems like Ellison, Redbird have a clearer path even now. But their challenge is to sweeten the deal so that shareholders of CBS don't revolt. Meanwhile, the Sony Apollo deal, which would seem to be simpler in terms of the money, has a bunch of complicating factors, including the fact that Sony, as a foreign company, cannot own American TV stations. If Apollo takes on the TV station ownership, they run into caps on the percentage of stations that can be owned by a particular company. And perhaps the biggest issue is that it's a deal because Sony is itself one of the big five. It would take the big five studios down to four. And none of that is the case with the Ellison, Skydance, Redbird deal. And then there's also the possibility that Sherry Redstone won't do anything and the stock price will continue to tank until at some point she has to do something. But remember, she fired the CEO, or I mean, he resigned, but come on. And there's like a triumvirate in charge of CBS. It seems like very much not built to last, but it's a mess. So things are happening behind the scenes, but we don't have an answer to the question of what is going to happen to Paramount. And we might not for a little while. It's possible.
Do you know what's so funny? I was in the Puck Slack the other day, and we have like a general room where people can just, you know, drop in updates about their lives or whatever. It's a Slack room. And oftentimes we will just talk about, we'll drop in, you know, tweets about stories that people have interest in. So someone drops in a tweet, I can't remember who, might have been the brilliant Dylan Byers, actually. But someone drops in a tweet about the kind of Sony Apollo stuff. And I, you know, post it to the room. I was like, dumb question that I think I know the answer to, but I would love to know. They can sue, right? Like if nothing happens, the shareholders can sue. And one of my brilliant colleagues, a guy named Eric Gardner, he writes this fantastic newsletter all about kind of the world of law. He said, there will be lawsuits no matter what. Like, no matter what happens, there will be lawsuits because there's been so much that you could argue, if depending on where you're coming from, that has been handled arguably. No, he didn't say this, but he was like, if I'm a lawyer and I'm thinking about this through, you can argue there's a lot of wrongdoing potentially happening. I'm hedging a lot of my words because no one at this podcast wants a lawsuit, and I don't want a lawsuit at Puck. But he was kind of saying you could see how this would play out. And the more I looked at it, the more I'm like, I really don't know if she sells. Like, I don't know. Like, at this point, Apollo is too good to give up, but here we kind of are. Skydance, I think, still wants it, but they're not going to be on. They're not going to be holding out forever. And it also doesn't seem like there's any actual movement, right? Like, it kind of seems like there's this huge stalling, and that comes from a place of, I think, an emotional attachment to a lineage of family that's been involved in this, to a legacy of saying, I don't want to see it all sold for parts. I'm worried how this will go. I'm worried about what this will reflect upon. Even though everyone, you have to imagine everyone in your corner is saying, like, sell. Like, you have to do this, especially if the stock gets to a certain number. And I just wonder what it looks like if it doesn't happen. Because I think we've been operating over at Downstream, certainly a few of us over at Puck, in terms of when we talk to each other, certainly it comes up in conversations with clients. I have a parrot. I think all of us have been operating under the idea that it will eventually sell for something. Like, eventually it will go. But if it doesn't, I think that even brings up a much an even more interesting dilemma, which is, well, what's Paramount then? Like, what is this company? What is Paramount Plus? What is Paramount Pictures? What is CBS, which I think is the strongest probably product out of all of them? You know, like, what is CBS News? Like, what is it? And I don't know if there are any clear-cut answers there, which, if I was a shareholder in this company, would be my largest concern. It's not even necessarily that I didn't get this huge potential buyout, right, with Sony Apollo deal. It's not that the Skydance thing didn't happen and David seemed to have an idea that Sherry and Bob Bakish is now out, the CEO's ousted, right? It's that, what is its role? It doesn't really exceed anywhere. Mm-hmm. And that would be my biggest concern. And I would not be surprised if that were to happen, if no sale were to happen, if you were not to see a huge stock runoff, right? Like, or the opposite of that, where people are just like, I don't know where this goes.
Yeah. The general consensus is she could have sold it a while ago for more. Now she's still holding on to it. And you're right, it doesn't necessarily make sense. The Ellison Skydance Redbird deal, even though it risks some shareholder lawsuits, at least would plausibly, although I said, an episode or two ago, it could all be a lie, but plausibly keeps her company's assets together long enough for her to feel some sort of pride in having kept the business together. But if the business doesn't make sense together, then, you know, why is it together? And yeah, you're right. Sentimentality and ego and all those things are going on in here too. And the world doesn't always proceed logically. And I think that's what's going on here a little bit too. Well, anyway, there's your Paramount update. Nothing happening, or things happening behind the scenes, but nothing clear. That brings us to Sports Corner.
Sports Corner.
Yeah. Three Sports Corner items for us this time. So much going on in sports. First, short one, but Spulu has a name. This is the joint venture that is going to put sports programming from ESPN, from Fox, and from who's the third in there? It's ESPN, Fox, and
Warner Brothers.
WBD.
Yeah.
Another Disney WBD hookup too. And of course, Disney and Fox, because they had their financial transaction. Anyway, it's going to be called Venu, V-E-N-U. So it's like Hulu, but not Spulu. But close, right? I mean, like, it's close to Hulu. Hulu and Venu, and they live together. It's Venu Sports, Venu. The idea here is it's going to be basically like an MVP PVD. It's going to be like a Fubo or a YouTube TV kind of, but for sports content only, which is why Fubo is suing them, saying we would like to do that. That's the whole premise of our company, but we have to buy bundle. Again, it's back to the cable bundle. We have to bundle all these channels we don't want and pay for them because otherwise
and we're reliant on the suppliers.
We can't get ESPN, and so we pay and we have all these other channels that we don't want, but we have to get them. So that's going on anyway. They still say that's coming in the fall. Going to be very interesting. Of course, ESPN is also working on a plan for 2025 for their own direct-to-consumer over-the-top service, which may or may not. I saw today there was an article that made me laugh about this that basically said, consider it a starter marriage. And somebody else said, like Hulu, actually, whatever Venu ends up as will probably go through several iterations before it gets there, but they want to do something. So here it is, Venu Sports.
What is your opinion? Because this has been happening in the background, and it's related to this. What is the value of WBD, already arguably the weakest player in this bundle already, to Venu if it doesn't have the NBA?
It's less, but
right.
But still some, right? And I have to think that part of the agreement between these three companies is some valuation based on the content, or based on like the content based on a formula of what they bring to the table over the course of a calendar year, or a valuation based on the, you know, use or the viewership of it. But I imagine there's something in there that says that if one of the partners is not contributing as much, they don't get as much, right? Like that's probably part of the deal. And so if they lose the NBA, yeah, that hurts. But they do still have some other stuff. WBD, they've got baseball playoffs, including one of the two championship series, and they got baseball during the year. They've got, what do they have? They have some auto racing. They've got some other stuff,
too.
They
got NASCAR, yeah.
Yeah, but less. I mean, if they lose the NBA, it's a lot less. That's
you have to
line.
Imagine, because I was looking at the Venu website, and so it was like the first thing that pops up. They have this video that auto plays, and the first thing that popped up was like the home of football, or like the NFL, and I was like, yeah, sure. I was like, I guess not really, it's like half, but like, yeah. And then it goes into like basketball. I was like, I wonder if you're Brian Roberts and you think you're Brian Roberts and Bob Iger famously fight, or not, they don't personally fight, but their companies don't like each other. And so, like, I wonder if you're kind of going, like, oh, we could own the NBA. Oh, we have football. Like, right? And so, but also, Venu was a response to NBC Universal and Paramount pulling their games off of, not off of, but offering an alternative feed at a time when these other guys couldn't.
Right, right. Because if you're a cord cutter, you can get NBC's local game in your area on Peacock, and you can get CBS's local game in your area on Paramount Plus, but Fox is not there and ESPN and ABC are not there. And so they've built this other thing. I will say they also have college basketball. They share the NCAA tournament with CBS.
Right, right.
So there's some of that stuff there. I think this is an interesting product. The only two things I have Fubo for are my local baseball and sports for sports. Let's just say that it's my local sports and also some national sports, and like Jeopardy. That's it. Like, that's literally it that I watch on Fubo. There's nothing else there. I mean, Survivor, I guess occasionally I still watch Survivor, but it's on Paramount Plus the next day. So I usually just watch it on Paramount Plus. So anyway, it there's a space here, but it I don't know. It's weird, and I actually kind of agree with Fubo in saying, wait a second, you're taking all your sports channels out of the bundle that you forced on everybody forever. But the net result might be that it's a better deal. Sure.
This is also just one quick backstory lesson for somebody who might be confused about, because it gets really confusing, especially with sports. CBS and NBC, so Paramount and NBC Universal,
yeah,
could pull or offer, not pull, I keep saying pull. They could offer a simultaneous streaming feed of live games. So think about the NFL.
Yes.
Because in the local markets, the broadcast affiliate still had the rights.
Yes.
So in local markets, you were still watching it via your broadcast affiliate. It's equivalent to a blackout, right? Like it's that they were able to do the exact same thing.
Yeah.
They didn't have to, they weren't fighting. ESPN, Fox Sports One, and remember Fox doesn't have a streaming service. This is like their first foray. And TNT never could.
Exactly.
Because the cable operators would then say, no, no, you are getting paid a certain amount of money for it to be exclusively here. To Jason's point, like when Fubo comes out and says that's what we're paying you for, it's that reason. The broadcast affiliates always had, or sorry, the broadcast networks always kind of had that potential to do it because they were still working with the affiliates in regional markets. And so it's funny because you will hear people say like this was a pushback against what NBC and CBS were doing. And on the one hand, of course, like I get it. Like they're propping up their streaming services with it. At the end of the day, no one really cares if why the NFL game is there. They just know it is there. But like ABC could always do this, right? It was ESPN that couldn't, and it was TNT that couldn't, and it was FS1 that couldn't. And now we're really seeing them say, okay, well, we're going to do this anyways. So that's an important thing to remember is when we talk about linear TV, that includes broadcast as well as cable. Cable actively declining, much harder to negotiate with the distributors on. Broadcast, still huge reach, actually seeing increase in viewership year after year, and is kind of outside some of these pay TV rules.
Yeah, exactly. So we'll see what happens with Venue. Interesting. Yeah, if I like it, I don't know. If I can put up an antenna and get Channel 7 so I can record Jeopardy, then, you know, maybe the jig is up then. I don't know. But that's an ABC affiliate. Maybe they should just slide the whole... They may... That's the other thing is we don't know what's in Venue Sports, and it may include a lot of channels that are, you know, like how WBD uses True TV, which used to be, you know, Headline News back in the day. They use that as a sports channel because they put some NCAA games on it. And so now it's a sports channel, so they can call it that. Like, some of these may be sports... in quotation marks, and it would not surprise me actually if it also included your local Fox and ABC affiliates.
No, it does.
Oh, it does officially?
I'm pretty sure, and I also think it's also non-sports entertainment. Like, it's like there's aspects of non-sports entertainment that will be available.
Yeah, it's basically, you know, Fubo, a YouTube TV, a Hulu Plus Live TV. Fascinating. Anyway, we'll keep an eye on it. It has a name. It's Venue. It's not Spulu anymore, but it's close. It's real close.
It'll be Spulu in our hearts forever.
Spulu forever. NFL, this is the big news. Maybe the biggest news of the last 2 weeks. The NFL, which for those outside the United States is the dominant sporting platform in the U.S. with, I think we said, it's like 92 of the 100 top rated programs in broadcast TV last year. In the U.S. were NFL games. Like,
yep.
it's that's what it is. People love the NFL in the U.S. And they made a deal. They made a bunch of deals like last year and the year before their new contract cycle for their partners, but they kept a carve out and they carved it out so that they could sell it to a streamer and they sold it to Netflix. Apparently, even though Amazon, who's already an existing NFL partner, kind of came in waving their arms and being like, no, we'll pay you anything and not sell to Netflix. And the NFL is like, no, we're going to sell to Netflix, which means the experimentation phase and like shout out to Netflix for doing their live John Mulaney talk show, which was really fun.
Insanely good.
Really
like
good.
They should find a way to give him a ton of money.
I love the idea of doing a seasonal talk show where every, you know, a couple times a year he does a week somewhere and does his talk show. But that was a live Netflix event. That was my first live Netflix event that I've participated in. And that was exciting. Well, the experimentation with live events at Netflix is over because here it is. Two NFL games on Christmas Day are going to be on Netflix. The NFL is getting paid a lot of money for the privilege, but this is also a flex by the NFL. And it's important to think about that too. Not only are they spreading this around to a new partner that is not Amazon, I assume that the NFL media group is going to produce these shows. It's a little like him, how MLB's group can produce shows for like Apple and is going to be producing it. I didn't even put this in here. Major League Baseball sold off this Sunday morning slot to Roku for $10 million or something like that. It's a minor deal. It's the deal that Peacock didn't want. So the NFL wanted to have Netflix as a partner. So they will, but this also means like Christmas Day was traditionally NBA Day. The NBA owned Christmas Day. And now there's two NFL games on Christmas Day. It's a Friday. They don't care. It's Friday. I mean, like they just don't care. The NFL doesn't care. They're going to do whatever, whenever. Oh, no, they have a different Friday game. This is like a Wednesday game or something, but they do not. Yeah, it's Wednesday. They do not care that the NBA is there. And then I'll just point out another note. As a part of the NFL schedule, they are also counter-programming the college football playoff, which is playing on a Saturday in December. And the NFL apparently went to them and said, please don't play three playoff games and take all of Saturday. Put two of them on Friday and two of them on Saturday, please. And the college football playoff said no to the NFL, to the 300-pound gorilla. They said no. And so what did the NFL do? They programmed two very good matchups for the same day. Basically, the NFL is settling all family business. They want to dominate, and they're not going to let anyone stop them. And that includes making a deal with Netflix. So here we are.
You know, there's two things that have come out of this Netflix story that one is a thing that I want to reiterate, because I keep seeing this going around and it's not accurate. And two is a question. So let's start with the question, because the question's a fun one. For those who don't know, right, that Prime Video has football. They have Thursday Night Football. It is produced, as in the production is done by NBC, because Prime Video does not have the production capabilities. And this is a huge deal for the NFL, right? The NFL, it very much is like it has to look like an NFL-worthy production. This is the last monoculture in the U.S. It is increasingly global, hence why they went with Netflix. And so we want to make sure it looks good. Who do you think does the production for Netflix?
Well, NFL media, I think, will probably do it. The NFL Network. Although, here's the thing. Rumor has it that NFL Network may be strategically right. Isn't they want to do a strategic investment in ESPN, and part of that deal might be that ESPN assumes the ownership of the NFL Network, in which case Disney would be doing the Netflix production, right?
Yeah, and I think they've got a good relationship. Like, I think I could also see, I mean, CBS and Netflix. Netflix
sure
needs a lot from CBS, sure, and CBS would like some money from Netflix.
They have to have a partner, and they've got their announcer teams, right? So I think that's the answer, is that Fox probably, yeah, I would say it's probably Fox or CBS, unless they, or, you know, or it's the NFL Network, because they've got announcers too. But you're right, Fox and CBS have teams of announcers who do games during the week and production trucks, and it would be fairly easy for them to just add this to their list.
I mean, this is why Amazon listed NBC. They don't have, and Netflix certainly does not have this in place, nor do they have the time to get that moving by the time December rolls around.
And I don't think, since it's a one-off, they're not going to hire announcers. At least Amazon is weekly, so they can have they can have their Al Michaels, Kirk Herbstreit combination and hire them, and they work the whole season. But this is two games on Christmas, which means really you need somebody else's announcers to come in for this. So that makes sense that you would pay somebody, and maybe it's Fox or CBS, and say, you know, hey, we would like you to, and obviously the branding is going to be Netflix and all of that, and the pregame show will be Netflix and all of that. But like to have the production truck and the camera operators and just everybody who goes in, the dozens of people who have to make an NFL broadcast happen, that'll come from someone.
Well, and here's the thing I keep seeing going around that kind of annoys me. If you haven't seen this, you will see this. There's a lot of comparisons being made between Netflix subs, US specifically, I think it's about 83 million, to ESPN subs, which sits at about 72 million.
Right.
And so everyone keeps going out and saying like Netflix has the larger audience in the US. So what does this mean, right? Like the, I love when apples to oranges stats are tried to be turned into apple to apple. When you look at ESPN, if you look at any data from any third-party firm, and as well as including internal data from a lot of these companies, fans of the NFL are 70% more likely to be fans of other sports. Of those other sports, a vast majority are carried on ESPN. ESPN has SportsCenter, which does cater to all fans of sports. ESPN and its subsequent networks are targeted directly at sports fans. So of the 72 million subscribers to ESPN, 72 million roughly, let's even say 60 million, let's take a percentage down, 60 million are sports fans. The more comparable statistic would be that there are about 75, 76 million cable subscribers in the U.S., and there's 82 million Netflix subscribers, because both are effectively four quadrant, meaning old, young, woman, man, viewers, except that we have decimated cable to the point that it's basically just sports and a little bit of news, right? Because all of the non-entertainment, non-sports viewing has gone to the streaming platforms.
And because cable has exclusive access to sports, I think cable is far highly, I mean, basically, if you're a sports fan, you probably have to have cable. Virtual or real, if you want to see the sports. That's why Spulu is going to exist, is because of that. So yeah, your average cable subscriber is far more likely to be watching sports than your average Netflix subscriber.
And statistically, if you look at it, the number one streaming service that many sports fans have in the United States on top of their cable bundle is Netflix. And so you're not reaching a larger or more impactful audience in the U.S. You might encounter some younger fans who don't really watch sports, who don't have cable, who are on Netflix, who might tune into the game. Like there's always that potential. But this is why it's so crucial to look at the actual incentive structure of that deal. And the key term is global. Like that is what the NFL wants. It's why the NFL likes Amazon and did that partnership. It was, how can you get me into the most homes internationally as I expand my UK games from one to three, as I go into Germany, as I go into Mexico, as I increase my time out there? And who am I going to partner with?
And this is an international worldwide deal. So everybody in the world will be watching these games on Netflix.
Right. So so when you're looking at who you're going to partner with, it's not a Disney right now. It could be, because Disney is definitely growing the fastest internationally outside of Netflix and Amazon. It's not Paramount. It's not WBD. It's not Comcast. It is going to be a Netflix or an Amazon. Amazon, you're also doubling down on an audience who would already have it, right? Yes. So Amazon wants it. They already have Thursday Night Football. Yeah. Audience is already there. So for Netflix, you've got a much larger entertainment and much larger international audience that has capabilities to see this on a day when a lot of people are at home. And so I think that was like, it makes the most sense. So when you're looking at these comparisons, keep in mind, if they are US specific comps, they are nonsensical, because it doesn't make any sense. International is where you want to be looking, and that's where all your data points should be coming from.
Absolutely. All right. One quick one before we go. Just wanted to do another update on Diamond. This is the owners of the Bally Sports channels, a lot of it's a regional sports network collection. Just an update to say there was a court event this week as part of their bankruptcy. Remember, Amazon gave them some funding because Amazon sees some value in picking them up and using them as a vehicle for local sports streaming. But to do that, they need to emerge from bankruptcy with their contracts intact. And it seems from this particular court hearing, like all of the leagues who are their partners for this are fed up, in part because Comcast has played hardball with Diamond and will not make them a deal. They want to put them on a digital tier that you have to pay extra for. Diamond has said, you got to put us on the regular tier. The idea here is that if you've got cable in Cincinnati, you wouldn't get the channel that has the Reds broadcast on it unless you pay extra. And of course, Diamond's like, no, you got to put us on the basic tier where we get, or, you know, the standard tier where we get money from everybody who's got cable in Cincinnati, or our finances don't work in Comcast. They've made deals with the two other huge cable companies, but not Comcast has not seemed interested. That puts this whole thing in peril, and the leagues are all saying they are an we can't count on Diamond, and we need to move on with our lives, and we don't believe that Diamond is going to solve this. So they're basically telling the judge, and Major League Baseball actually filed something that basically said, we oppose this. This doesn't make any sense. Now, all the leagues, I would say, benefit with not just clarity, but getting their rights back. But because then they could sell them to Amazon, and Amazon will have to pay them instead of sort of just taking the Diamond contract. But it's still, the short version is, it's still up in the air. But unless a deal with Comcast gets made and some other things get put together, Diamond's journey has gotten more and more perilous. So that's just something to keep in mind as we watch this, as we watch regional sports networks fall apart. That is it for this episode. We have some letters. We're going to save them for next episode because we went long. We actually are more than an hour here. Good episode. It's so like us to go long too, but we do have room. If you want to send in letters, we'll do some more letters next time. Downstreamfeedback.com is the place to do it. And if you haven't yet, please consider subscribing to Downstream Plus. This was a full-sized episode for everyone, but the only way to hear the complete version of our next episode will be to subscribe. Downstream.plus to subscribe and support the show. You can find Julia at ParrotAnalytics.com and, of course, read her stuff at Puck.news. You will find me at SixColors.com, and I appear on many other podcasts at RelayFM and TheIncomparable.com. That's it for this time. We'll be back in a couple of weeks. Until next time, Julia, say goodbye.
Bye.